From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Eric Westervelt. It's Here and Now. Rear Admiral Ronnie Jackson today bowed out of consideration to be President Trump's pick to lead the Department of Veterans Affairs amid allegations of inappropriate behavior and fostering a hostile work environment. The White House doctor denied the allegations. In a statement, Jackson said he expected tough questions, but he denounced what he called baseless and anonymous attacks on my character and integrity. In a call to Fox News this morning, the president defended Jackson.
He would have done a great job. He's got tremendous heart.
Any idea who you might...
These are all false accusations that were made. These are false. They're trying to destroy a man. By the way, I did say welcome to Washington, welcome to the swamp, welcome to the world of politics.
Well, welcome to the world of politics. We're joined by NPR's lead politics editor, Domenico Montanaro. Hi, Domenico.
Hey there. I'm just going to make that my walk-up slogan every time. I'm just going to play Trump beforehand. Welcome to the world of politics.
Welcome to the swamp, the jungle.
There we go.
So this is a president that seems to value personal connections and loyalty above just about everything else when picking his staff. There are frustrations really on both sides of the aisle, it seems, about lax vetting of staff. I mean, do you think there'll be any White House lessons learned from the Ronnie Jackson nomination?
Well, they should learn some of those lessons. I'm not sure that they're going to take a whole bunch away from it. They could have prevented a lot of these bad headlines had they done some of this vetting beforehand and tried to figure some of this out. Now, what is interesting is that you've heard a lot of Obama, ex-Obama folks saying good things about Ronnie Jackson as well. And, you know, we should still note that these are allegations that haven't been confirmed, although you've had some almost two dozen military personnel who've apparently been the ones behind these allegations. So clearly there was more to be known that the Trump administration is falling down on when it comes to their vetting.
Well, and as you point out, he continues to be praised by the White House and former presidents. So can he keep his current job as White House physician, do you think, with so many of these unanswered allegations swirling about him?
Well, technically he can, and Sarah Sanders, the press secretary at the White House, said that for now, yes, he will remain as the White House doctor. It wouldn't surprise me if he decides to get out of the public spotlight, especially if the questions keep being asked about him and his job performance, because this wasn't just about his experience level to manage a bureaucracy like the VA. It's also about his performance on the job and, you know, if he were, as the allegations note, drinking overseas on trips. Well, you know, he's a former combat doctor. If you're in a place where the president gets sick, are you going to trust an emergency room in Caracas as opposed to the White House doctor who's supposed to be really good at this? In the United States, it probably obviously is not as big of an issue because you've got plenty of great hospitals and good doctors very close by.
Let's move on to EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt. He's had to answer some tough questions today in a congressional hearing. Pruitt's been charged with several ethical violations, from exorbitant travel accommodations, unauthorized wage increases to staff members, close ties to oil and gas lobbyists, and more. Here's how Pruitt defended himself in his opening statement.
Much of what has been targeted towards me and my team has been half-truths or, at best, stories that have been so twisted they do not resemble reality. And I'm here to set the record straight in these areas. But let's have no illusions about what was really going on here. Those who have attacked the EPA and attacked me are doing so because they want to attack and derail the president's agenda and undermine this administration's priorities. I'm simply not going to let that happen.
So, Domenico, Scott Pruitt, is framing this criticism in partisan terms. Have Republican lawmakers who questioned him today, sort of bought into that reasoning that this is all partisan?
Well, they certainly haven't asked him any tough questions when it comes to some of these ethics scandals. They have more so kind of defended him. I listened to North Dakota Congressman Kevin Cramer just before coming on, asking him questions and talking about, how Democrats are defending secret science. Of course, North Dakota is a big fracking state and a place that's seen a huge oil boom. So, the local interests are important as well. That's why you see West Virginia congressmen and senators more defending the role control of this new EPA because under the Obama administration, there was stricter regulation of some of these practices. And you saw Democrats today going after him quite a bit on substance. You had congressmen and women like Debbie Dingell asking questions about specific policies and whether or not the EPA has conducted reviews on the potential impact of people's health. And he couldn't answer those questions. So, you know, there are a lot of policy questions that were discussed. And when it came to the ethics scandals, again, you saw him try to deflect toward it being partisan politics and blaming others within the EPA.
Finally, Michael Cohen, the president's personal lawyer, said he would take the Fifth in this lawsuit filed by Stormy Daniels. Cohen paid the adult movie actress $130,000 for her silence. I mean, do you think this decision to take the Fifth, how will it impact the case? What do you think?
Well, look, it's going to make it more difficult for investigators to get the information that they had wanted. They'd also kind of been hoping that he might turn and be somebody who they could use as a witness rather than a subject here. So it certainly is a little damaging to the Mueller investigation. But, you know, we'll see how far that winds up going. It's interesting that the president seemed to undercut him and the case against him because he said that he didn't really think of him as a lawyer. He thought of him more as a businessman. Well, that sort of takes down or undercuts the idea of attorney-client privilege. And he also said that Cohen represented him, explicitly said that he represented him in the Stormy Daniels affair. And that, you know, certainly makes it look like the president knew about the payouts when he said he hasn't.
It certainly complicates things. Domenico Montanaro, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Well, teacher walkouts are underway today in both Arizona and Colorado, and they appear to have support. A new NPR Ipsos poll out today shows that Americans largely don't think teachers are paid fairly, and around three-quarters think teachers do have the right to strike. In Arizona, tens of thousands of teachers and their supporters are expected to march today in Phoenix as part of the hashtag RedForEd movement. Over 800,000 students in Arizona are expected to be affected by the strike today, potentially making it the largest walkout in the country in recent history. Casey Kuhn is a reporter at KJZZ. Casey, we understand teachers in Arizona are among the lowest paid in the country.
Yeah, they're paid about in the bottom 10 as far as ranking goes, as far as average teacher pay. Some numbers look at the median, that's even lower, and teachers are kind of fed up. You know, I mean, if you keep not getting raises or your pay keeps being frozen over years and years, it's something that is clearly frustrating. And some teachers even say that their contracts are lower than the year before, even though they were promised raises. Some teachers say their contracts are lower than they were 10 years ago.
Well, they're asking for an immediate 20% pay raise just to get to the national average. They want to go from $47,000 average in Arizona a year to the $58,000 national average. But the governor has offered a 20% raise by 2020. Is there any room for compromise there?
I think that's a great question. I think the governor would like that plan to go through. He's doubled down on it today. He's doubled down on it when the teachers announced they were going to walk out. The teachers say that this plan that he's proposed just isn't sustainable. It doesn't restore school funding that they say has been cut and has been cut over the last decade or so.
$1 billion.
Yeah, $1 billion. And there have been plans put in place to restore some of that money, but rightfully so. Some of the teachers say that this one proposal that was voted into effect called Proposition 123 was supposed to inject $3.5 billion back into the school system. Well, that's supposed to settle a lawsuit that says that the schools had been like woefully underfunded. And that's only about 70% of that settlement. So teachers are saying, okay, the governor has said he's going to put more money in, and he has technically put more money into the school system, but it's not something that he's followed through with. It's not something that has come to fruition in a way that is sustainable, and especially in this proposal, which hasn't even been proposed in the legislature and still needs to be voted on if it goes through.
Well, I understand he says he will absolutely not raise taxes. That's another thing that teachers are suspicious of. But they want that money restored. They want to raise spending levels to pre-recession levels. Why didn't spending increase after the economy recovered?
Right. So kind of going back to his proposal, that actually does factor in a very sunny economic forecast, basically saying that our surplus is going to increase because of the higher money that's coming into our economic system. So if we look at the numbers, basically over the last 10 years, they've been taking money from the school system and use it to help pay for recession problems. Money has been restored in some places, but in other places, the schools basically have to raise the money themselves. They have to put on ballots, voter overrides or bonds, basically to get their capital funding, which is another problem that teachers say their desks are falling apart, their school textbooks are 25 plus years old. And that's money also that they say needs to be restored.
Well, we've seen strikes now. Oklahoma, West Virginia went on for a long time. Is this legal in Arizona? Because we know there was a 1971 Arizona Attorney General opinion that a statewide strike would be illegal.
So it's a little unclear at this point whether or not this is illegal. The state superintendent says it is, and that teachers could possibly lose their job. They could possibly lose their teaching certification. But it still remains to be seen. I mean, a lot of the districts have supported, not necessarily a walkout, but they've supported their teachers through this Red for Ed campaign. And if teachers got fired, that would make the news. So is it illegal? Maybe. What's going to happen? It's right for work state. And in fact, they're calling it a walkout, not a strike, just for that reason.
Casey Kuhn of KJZZ in Phoenix. Casey, thank you.
Thank you so much.
A new book looks at the history of the Cherokee Nation through the lens of a bitter rivalry between two powerful chiefs and how their feud shaped the tribe's history. Blood Moon takes readers from the arrival of white settlers through the Trail of Tears and the U.S. Civil War, and its vivid detail and descriptions bring to life the nuanced and often bloody history of the Cherokee Nation. Here's author John Sedgwick reading a passage about the ambush of an outlaw Indian named Doublehead by a young chief known as the Ridge.
With a roar, Doublehead closed on the Ridge and wrapped his meaty arms around him. He pushed him backward onto the floor, reaching with his good hand for an eye to puncture or flesh to claw, lifting his knee into the Ridge, hoping to jam it into a soft place. Doublehead smeared the Ridge everywhere with his hot blood.
And author John Sedgwick joins us from New York to talk about Blood Moon. John, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you for having me.
John, I want to start with the details. I mean, the book is pretty vivid. It includes treaties and narratives, but also some gory battle scenes. How did you uncover some of these meticulous details, you know, not only about the battles, but about conversations, the relationships, especially since the Cherokee had no written language?
Well, I'll tell you, it wasn't easy. But fortunately, there had been historians that went before me, and their work, unfortunately, had faded from the spotlight. But they were able to steer me to the letters, the diaries, the newspaper accounts that would allow me to sort of fill out my story with the details.
So, John, let's get to the protagonists of this book. There's a chief called The Ridge. He's mostly Cherokee, though he does have at least one Scottish ancestor. But he was born to a Cherokee mother, raised speaking Cherokee, had a shaman present at his birth. His bitter rival was John Ross. He is only one Cherokee great-grandparent. He spoke only English. Tell us more about these two giants of Cherokee history.
They were the two great leaders of the Cherokee Nation. They were the Hamilton and the Jefferson of the Cherokee. A study in contrast, as you said before, shaped the outcome of the nation far more than anything that the American government did. John Ross, as you said, 5'5", as white as I am, not that your listeners can see me, but I'm extremely white. He wore a top hat, leather shoes, whereas the Ridge was a classic Cherokee warrior, 6'2", copper-skinned, powerful, and amazingly, neither spoke the other's language, as you say. And yet they combined to create the modern Cherokee government that was styled after the American government, an extraordinary story. I mean, they had a constitution, they had a legislature, they had a Supreme Court. They worked together to create that, and then they disagreed over this terrible pending issue of removal.
We'll get to the removal issue, but first I want to talk a little bit more about these two and about the Cherokee. I mean, you know, while there were certainly skirmishes between white settlers and Indians, of course, you know, you point out these allegiances and alliances were always shifting, and it wasn't always white versus Indian. There was Indian versus Indian. And in fact, in many cases, as you point out, it was hard to tell by looking at people, you know, who was white and who was Indian. Talk some about that.
You're absolutely right. And in fact, this was a story of a people in evolution, a very rapid evolution. For literally 20,000 years, life was pretty much the same until the whites came in number in the late 17th century, at which point the Cherokee gradually had to face this terrible decision. Should they evolve to become, in effect, like whites in order to pass with these white powers so that they would let them alone or at least respect them? Or should they hang on to their own identity and stay as they always were? And on top of that, of course, the whites married in to the Cherokee and gradually shifted the color of their skin. In the case of the two that I looked at, of course, John Ross was mostly white. The Ridge was mostly Cherokee, but his children became whiter and whiter, both by affect and by the marriages that they themselves had.
Let's look at removal and this big split between these two giants of the Cherokee. Let's talk about the Trail of Tears. This is when the rivalry really kind of takes off. President Andrew Jackson passed the Indian Removal Act in 1830. It forced the removal of the six tribes from their ancestral lands. The last were the Cherokee. But you show that tribes were deeply divided over whether they should go.
Well, it was a terrible decision for the Cherokee. At the time of the Trail of Tears, there were probably 20,000 Cherokee, with literally millions of white settlers encroaching on every side. They had no standing army. They had a fledgling economy. They got little respect from Washington. Their future was bleak in the East. And the Ridge saw that the numbers were against them and saw that not only was the pressure coming from the East, from the federal government and Jackson, but more importantly, from Georgians who had taken it upon themselves literally to seize Cherokee property once they discovered that there was gold in those hills.
So stealing property, and he was kind of a realist saying, we have no choice.
We have no choice. We got to get out of town here. We have no future. It's just going to get worse. They were getting slaughtered. They were getting whipped. They had no standing in courts. They had no defenses. And Ross, who had his following among the traditional Cherokee, the so-called full-bloods, who were relatively ignorant about what was going on in the wider world and wanted to hunker down and stay, he thought that because of his political base that he should play to them and that he should try and stay also. And that dispute set them against each other big time.
John, there's a section of the book that speaks to that exactly. If you could read that section.
If the Cherokee insisted on staying, they could do so only as citizens of the United States, Jackson declared, for the Cherokee Nation would be no more. It was an imperious position, and it said a lot about Jackson's high regard for himself and his low regard for Indians. It was the same raw deal that Jefferson had offered long before. Leave as Cherokee or stay as Americans. The Cherokee would be gone either way.
And talk about the fallout for the Cherokee. The Trail of Tears, we know from a broad sweep and the horror of it, this forced removal.
It was horrendous because there was a divide. There was a class divide in some ways because the Ridge had his followers among the more elite, the more prosperous, the more nimble, the more adaptable people. The other people, the full-bloods that were the backers of Ross, couldn't move so easily. They were essentially lower class, that they had fewer opportunities. They needed to stay where they were. Well, those were the ones who were blindsided by the removal, that they had been told by Ross that they wouldn't have to remove, and so they were completely unprepared. When it turned out they did, they were rousted out of their homes at gunpoint, some of them interrupted at dinner. They were grabbed, they were sent onto these nasty keelboats that tipped this way and that, going up the raging Tennessee, and sent to, in their minds, God knows where. It might have been to the far side of the moon as far as they were concerned. They had no idea where Oklahoma was or how to get there or what they would do when they arrived. Thousands died en route and thousands more died of starvation and of disease once they arrived. It was a cataclysm for the Cherokee people.
John, this split continues right into the American Civil War, the Ross and the Ridge factions splitting north and south. Talk about that.
Well, it's incredible that this dispute between Ross and Ridge, once they create the country together, they divide over the issue of removal. And spoiler alert, I have to tell you what happens. Ross's people ended up killing not only Ridge, but his nephew and his son, who were the three leaders of his faction. That set the Cherokee Nation into convulsions. There was a civil war within the tribe in Oklahoma. And then it was not fully resolved, even at the time of the Civil War, so that once that war broke out, the war between the states, that the Cherokee had a natural affinity for the Confederate side. They aspired to be Southern plantation owners. Incredibly enough, they kept slaves themselves. The other side, the Ross faction, came in on the side of the Union in order to continue this fight between themselves. It had nothing to do with the larger issues of the greater war.
John, there have been some criticisms of the book. One is that Blood Moon perpetuates stereotypes of Native Americans. One writer lists long hair, face paint, terrifying war cries, knives, tomahawks, and scalpings as part of what he saw as demeaning depictions of a complex culture. Do you think those criticisms are unfounded? How do you answer that?
I welcome them, quite honestly. They speak to the core issues of the book, which is who are the Cherokee and also who defines them and by what standards. The Cherokee people themselves, as I said, were in this kind of evolution within the context of white culture. Well, how should they relate to it? Should they aspire to the standards of the whites? Should they allow the whites to define them? Or should they hunker down and be the people that they always were? These are important questions to address, and they have to do with identity, with cultural assimilation, and with the issues that are central to all Americans today. I welcome them.
John, you write about how the Ridge tried to understand Christianity and realized for the first time the concept of right and wrong as opposed to just necessary. Were John Ross and the Ridge driven in the end by right and wrong or just necessary? I mean, could it have ended any differently in your view?
That's an excellent question, and frankly, I don't see how it could have ended any differently in any substantive way. The Cherokee did suffer more than the other tribes. I think that if they had recognized that this simply was going to happen, they would have to leave, they could have adjusted more easily, and their accommodations might better have been made for them. But as it was, they were, as I say, they were blindsided by this. It went a lot worse for that reason, and I attribute that to this dispute within the nation as to whether this was going to happen or not.
John Sedgwick's new history is Blood Moon, an epic of war and splendor in the Cherokee Nation. John, thank you for speaking with us.
Oh, it's such a pleasure to be with you. Thank you.
The NFL held its first player draft in 1936, and there was really no media coverage at all. When the 2018 draft begins tonight, it'll be pretty hard to escape the coverage. There are draft preview magazines. There are mock drafts. Alien life landing in the stadium in Arlington, Texas tonight, where the draft is held, might think the NFL is the biggest thing on earth. Maybe it is. Mike Pesca is here now, sports analyst. He hosts The Gist at Slate.com, and he joins us now from outer space. Mike, I like your spaceship, man.
Yeah, thanks for having me. You know, back in 1936, the Whig Party, I think, was still an ongoing thing. So it's really unfair to compare that.
True. So history shows us, a lot of top draft picks are busts. How did this become such a big deal, such must-see TV?
The TV part of it is a bit perplexing, although let's credit the marketing of the NFL and the fact that NFL fans are extremely passionate, and even for terrible teams, hope springs eternal, and they've created it, as most professional drafts do, of giving the worst teams the first couple picks. So, for instance, I, as a Jet fan, wind up writing off my team somewhere in the middle of the season and start looking forward to the draft.
Right, right. And the Cleveland Browns, once again, have the first pick, and they have the fourth pick as well. They haven't won a championship, Mike, since 1964. It'd be kind of charitable to say they haven't drafted well in recent years. I mean, any sense the Browns will draft better this time, or are they just going to put their pick on a roulette table in Vegas?
Well, a couple things. When you say they haven't won a championship since 1964, let's note the phrasing. I mean, they haven't won a championship since pre-Super Bowl. When they won a championship, it was a championship. Mm. So they sort of, as Meryl Streep is to the Oscars, they are to the top of the NFL draft, not in terms of achievement, but in terms of just presence. They're always picking high because they're always such a bad team. I do have to say, their GM, their upper management, seems to be a lot more on the ball the last couple of years. They've had a change in management, and they have two of the top four picks. So between them, yeah, I don't know if you're a Browns fan, you could say two busts. But I would say that, you know, you have two shots at getting that franchise quarterback. Maybe they'll be able to do it for the first time since Bernie Kosar.
Let's talk about quarterbacks. I mean, I think there are four or five college quarterbacks that could go pretty high up. Talk about them a little bit.
Yeah, the really interesting thing about the draft, and it is incredibly overrated because if you really look at the correlation between drafting well and being a good team, it's not exactly there. I think it's more that good teams seem to draft well because they develop players. So is it that they select good players or that they know how to coach? Mm-hmm. And I'll answer your quarterback question in a second. Like, look at the New England Patriots. Going back through 2009, they've only had one top 20 pick, yet they're in Super Bowls all the time. So it tells me that drafting or getting a top pick is not that important. But if it is important, it is very hard to coach up a quarterback who doesn't come into the league without a lot of skills. And it's very hard to acquire a quarterback on the free agent market without breaking the bank who's going to lead your team to a Super Bowl. Although backup quarterback for the Eagles, Nick Foles, certainly did that. So yeah, we're looking at four guys who could go in the top 10, could go in the top 20. And there's a big debate about where exactly Josh Allen, Sam Darnold, Josh Rosen, or the fourth guy will go. It'll hit me in a sec. Baker Mayfield. He could go number one. He's the guy from Oklahoma.
Go to the Browns. That's possible. He could go to the Browns. Good luck to the Jets. Mike Pesca is here now, sports analyst. He's also editor of the new book, Upon Further Review. Mike, thank you.
You're welcome.
Come on, admit it. Many of the apps on your smartphone are for fun or distraction. But there are apps out there that do good and help people with a disability. For people who are blind or visually impaired, there's Be My Eyes, an app that asks a sighted person for help through a video call. I've been one of the many thousands of Be My Eyes volunteers for a few years now. Maybe once a month I'll get a video call from a blind person asking for my help with basic things. Can you tell me the cooking or assembly instructions on this package? Is this shirt red or blue? To find out how much mobile tech has or hasn't changed things for blind or visually impaired people, we're joined by Mark Riccobono, president of the National Federation of the Blind. Mark, you're blind. Has the explosion of mobile tech changed anything fundamentally about how you live and get around?
Well, like everybody else, the availability of technology and access to information instantaneously is really what's key. Technology is not what gives blind people capacity, but technology solves one of the fundamental problems that blind people face, which is access to information.
But has the rise and sort of dominance of the smartphone and the tablet marked any kind of improvement for blind and visually impaired people, in your view?
Yes, in some fundamental ways, because the focus is less on specialized technology and more on mainstream access to technology. So the iPhone is a good example. Mm-hmm. You know, we can go down to the Apple store and I can buy this very same iPhone that you buy, and by triple-clicking the home button have access to the accessibility features, which for blind people, Apple calls VoiceOver, which means when you touch something on the screen, VoiceOver will read out loud what the icon is, and it changes the gesture set a little bit. You can touch something without activating it, whereas when you touch it, it'll automatically activate it. But it's basically the same technology, and it speaks the things that are on the screen. I can connect it to a Bluetooth Braille display and read everything on the screen in Braille. So while you think I'm taking notes in a meeting, I'm really checking my Twitter feed or seeing what the next episode of Here and Now is going to be all about. We're going to now start to see some convergence where some of what used to be specialized technology, I think, will be leveraged by other people in society. I mean, just take, for example, the physical environment. People with disabilities use curb cuts all the time. Mm-hmm. But they're not the primary people that use curb cuts. Moms and dads with strollers, people traveling with luggage, curb cuts, which effectively were supposed to be for people with disabilities, have really enabled functionality in all sorts of ways. Again, this built-in accessibility is really critical. But there are some specialized applications. You mentioned Be My Eyes.
Do you use that, and what do you think of it?
Be My Eyes, I think, is a great innovation. I have used Be My Eyes. My wife and I are both blind. I could FaceTime a friend or relative, but, you know, at 11:30 p.m. when I may want to, as you said, find out what color a shirt is or look at some instructions on something, I don't want to call my friends that late. You know, they might be asleep, so that we can leverage the mobile technology to connect people for those short visual things that we just don't have access to information right now automatically with is really huge.
Mark, how does this technology compare to Braille readers, and is it integrated with this new technology?
There have been proprietary electronic Braille devices for decades, but those devices required the content to be loaded onto the device. Now, with Bluetooth, the ability to connect a refreshable Braille display to a mainstream smartphone or tablet, a blind person can have instant access to all of the content on those devices or in the cloud in Braille right under their fingers. So they can read, they can view the spelling of words, they can edit documents, and no one will even know they originally typed it in Braille. So Braille actually is seeing a resurgence, and its vitality is greater than ever before.
Mark, looking at another potentially revolutionary technology, do you think driverless cars could fundamentally change transportation for the visually impaired? I mean, presumably a fully autonomous vehicle won't need the passenger to be sighted.
We believe that autonomous vehicles hold great promise for blind people. We're very involved in the autonomous vehicle development, especially pushing the technology manufacturers and the car companies to make sure that these cars are accessible to blind people from day one. You know, I don't want to get into an autonomous vehicle and have to call my neighbor and say, can you come program the car to take me to Starbucks rather than to work this morning? So the interfaces inside the car have to be accessible. And a lot of people think, well, you'll just be able to talk to it. Well, we need other ways to interface as well. I mean, you've probably tried to talk to your smartphone, and that works some of the time,
right,
and not others. So luckily, because of our advocacy, I think there's a lot of great momentum to make sure that these cars are fully accessible on day one.
That's Mark Riccobono, president of the National Federation of the Blind. Mark, thank you.
Thank you very much.
The Centers for Disease Control released new numbers yesterday showing a substantial increase in the prevalence of autism spectrum disorders. One in 59 children in the U.S. is now on the spectrum. That's up from one in 68 2 years ago. The ballooning number of diagnoses has led to long wait times, often measured in months, for services. Blake Farmer from member station WPLN in Nashville reports on how telemedicine is being used as a stopgap to try to serve more children.
Modern technology makes treatment via video relatively simple. The Autism Center at Vanderbilt University Medical Center in Nashville just ships families an iPad on a special tripod that they can tilt up and down and side to side from afar in order to follow the child.
No, sir, no, sir. That's not an iPad for playing with. No, sir.
Stacy Copeland redirects her 2.5-year-old son, River. They're set up on the floor of their playroom, nearly 3 hours away in Knoxville, for a behavioral therapy session. Copeland tries to get River to play with a ball before moving on to toys he enjoys more.
I am waiting. First ball, then puzzle.
Stacy, I might give the direction one more time and then go ahead and prompt a follow-through.
Alicia Stainbrook directs this program at Vanderbilt. She has a $3 million grant from the state of Tennessee to use telemedicine for both autism diagnosis and therapy. Therapists around the country have been experimenting with video sessions over the last couple of years, primarily to reach families in rural areas, but also in cities that lack enough autism specialists.
Let's try sticking with the clapping for a couple of rounds and see if that repetition helps a little bit.
Okay, are you ready? I've got the six. Are you ready? Do this. Watch mommy.
For Copeland and her son, much of the strategy they've developed over months of only video sessions is pausing just before doing something River wants to do and prompting him to do something he doesn't, whether that's saying a word or making eye contact. Sometimes Copeland has him dig toys out of a bowl of beads to practice managing sensory overload.
Anybody can get in the floor and play with their kid, but you want play that's effective and helping modify behavior.
Even as a registered nurse who has done plenty of autism homework on her own, Copeland says you need someone feeding ideas in the moment. The big question is whether that can be done well from an iPad, Stainbrook says.
The challenge that we have to overcome is that we're not able to say, hey, let me try that with River.
Researchers in Iowa found that this kind of teletherapy was still effective, and it was done at less than half the cost, mostly by cutting travel expenses. Therapists spend lots of time on the road since sessions are ideally conducted in the child's home. University of Iowa professor Scott Lindgren says therapists might spend more than an hour on the road each way, only to have a session fall through.
The therapists who were traveling out to the homes would get out there and find out that somebody was sick or the parents got called away or there was some reason why they had wasted a trip.
Lindgren says more autism experts are still needed to handle the increasing caseload, but telemedicine allows therapists to spend more time productively.
Not the total fix. I think it certainly allows us to stretch our resources further.
Lindgren is more concerned about trying to conduct an initial visit via video since it's often such a sensitive moment with life-changing implications. But some medical centers, like Vanderbilt, are even experimenting with diagnosing from afar, seeing it as a way to make sure more kids get a diagnosis before they're 3 years old. For Here and Now, I'm Blake Farmer in Nashville.
April marks Dalit History Month. Dalits are the lowest caste in South Asia's caste system. At more than 3,000 years old, the caste hierarchy is one of the oldest forms of social stratification. Historically, the community you're born into in places like India, Pakistan, and Nepal has determined where you work and who you marry. Sonia Paul reports that a new survey finds that caste discrimination is playing out in the United States as well.
The church auditorium in Cambridge, Massachusetts is packed with over 100 people. And Dr. Cornell West is at the podium for a Black Lives Matter solidarity event with Dalits.
That spirit is finding joy in solidarity with magnificent human beings who are struggling for freedom.
He's drawing parallels between the struggles of Black Americans and those of South Asians on the lowest rungs of the caste system. For decades, Dalits and Black Americans have stood side by side while fighting for civil rights.
We will not be crushed. And we will struggle for love and justice, not hatred and revenge, love and justice.
West is here to help announce the results of a survey commissioned by Equality Labs, a South Asian American human rights startup. It includes the experiences of about 1,200 people who volunteered their answers. It found that two-thirds of Dalits surveyed have faced workplace discrimination due to their caste. 41% have experienced discrimination in education because of it. And a quarter of Dalits say they face physical assault, all in the U.S. Tenmori Sundararajan is the executive director of Equality Labs and co-authored the report. She says increased immigration from South Asia, including more and more people from lower castes, fuel this discrimination.
We have people who responded that were in the assembly line for a Campbell soup factory in Central Valley, as well as people who worked for Google and Facebook and the other big tech companies.
And this survey provides data for what many in the community already know. Anytime there's a dominant population of South Asians, whether they're living in Silicon Valley or New Jersey, or working at an office or a restaurant, caste biases emerge. It could be anything from refusing to date or marry someone from a lower caste, to being on the receiving end of a casteist slur, to being made to sit separately because of your perceived untouchability. It's hard for people to speak up about it or bring it to court. Most Americans don't understand caste dynamics. Anupama Rao is a historian and anthropologist at Barnard College who studies caste. She says for years, many of the so-called model minority of South Asians, who have earned the status of being, quote, good immigrants in the U.S., came from upper caste families.
Many of them, once they are upwardly mobile in the United States, tend to be extremely cagey sometimes, but most often, I think, embarrassed to think of themselves as the beneficiaries of caste privilege.
Which means caste discrimination is essentially invisible to many South Asians in America. What makes it even harder to combat is that some lower caste people hide their identity as well. 52% of Dalits surveyed worry about being outed as lower caste. But this issue is polarizing. Suhak Shukla is the executive director of the advocacy group the Hindu American Foundation. She says it's important to get rid of caste prejudice, but that this new survey unfairly essentializes and villainizes Hinduism.
The single most problematic issue with the survey is that it traffics in the most dangerous and false tropes about Hinduism.
As the survey notes, caste first appeared in Hindu scriptures. It now pervades all religions of South Asia. Shukla says that for many second, third, or fourth generation South Asian kids, caste discrimination isn't even on their radar. They're worried about the discrimination they face for being brown in America. Yet others, both Hindu and non-Hindu, see this defense as helping to preserve the caste system itself.
Even in the course of,
back at the Black Lives Matter event, Tenmori Sundararajan points out the shared experiences of those in the room.
Places like this, where oppressed peoples are starting to build our connections, this is freedom.
While hate crimes against Muslims and South Asians are at their highest level since the year after 9/11, these new data show oppression comes from many places. For NPR News, I'm Sonia Paul in Cambridge.
Before we end the hour, we want to note yesterday's news that California police, who've been tracking the Golden State Killer for decades, believe they've found him. They made an arrest based on DNA evidence. Here's Sacramento District Attorney Anne-Marie Schubert yesterday.
We found the needle in the haystack, and it was right here in Sacramento.
And it's a former police officer, Joseph James D'Angelo, picked up by police at his home half a mile from where the crimes began. The Golden State Killer is thought to have killed 12, raped dozens more from the 1970s to the 80s. D'Angelo's so far been charged with 8 counts of murder. Police credited the best-selling book I'll Be Gone in the Dark from true crime journalist Michelle McNamara with shining light on the case. Her husband, comedian Patton Oswalt, published it after her sudden death. We'll link you to our conversation, but here's his response to the arrest on Late Night with Seth Meyers.
She always said, I don't care about credit. I want to know that he's in jail, and now he's caught. The bracelets are on, and it feels like this thing that she wanted so badly is now done. Like, it just feels amazing.
And we'll follow the story to see if that turns out to be true. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Eric Westervelt. You're listening to Here and Now.